Welcome to Enough, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mandy Leto, ex-investment banker turned executive coach. This is a show for high achievers in fast-paced careers who, in spite of their stellar achievements, never feel quite good enough. You've got one gear, overdrive, and because of the sunk cost in your career, the long hours, the sacrifices, you have this niggling feeling that you should be further ahead by now. You're secretly thinking, is this it? Is this all there is? Oh, and you're tired, bored, and maybe even burnt out. But almost no one would know because you're an expert at managing your image. I feel you because I've been there too. I share the experts, techniques, and insights I've encountered in 16 years of coaching senior executives. You'll hear about topics like perfectionism, people-pleasing, burnout, and finding purpose in your work again. The aim here is to explore a more sustainable way of working and who you are outside of your achievements. I'm so glad you're here. Hey, have you ever been told to speak up at work, to talk louder, to say more things in meetings, share your ideas and views? It sounds stupid simple, but if you've ever been at the receiving end of that well-intentioned feedback, speaking up isn't always that straightforward or welcomed, is it? Today's guest is Elaine Lynn Herring, author of Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Lead with Courage. She's been a lecturer at Harvard Law School and a managing partner at a global leadership development firm. Elaine's clients have included Nike, Google, Pixar, and many others. She's also a delightful human. We deep dive into silence, how we silence ourselves, how we silence others, and how it's baked into the system. You'll learn that there's often good reason to stay silent in some corporate situations. Politics, power dynamics, challenging individuals. Unsilencing oneself can be especially challenging if you're not from the dominant culture. This conversation feels like a masterclass meets mentoring session meets real-life coaching. I've given Elaine some corporate dilemmas that I've collected and anonymized from my executive coaching practice over the years, and I think you're going to love how practical this conversation is. I drop you right in where Elaine shares where her learned silence came from and why silence is both pervasive and a problem for every single one of us. That includes how you might unknowingly be silencing others around you, no matter how approachable or well-intentioned you might be. Ready? Let's dive in.
I am the youngest daughter of an immigrant family from Taiwan to the United States. I am female in a patriarchal culture. I also grew up in the Christian church, where I was told, turn the other cheek, be the bigger person. There is validity to a lot of that, but overextended, overused means that you lose yourself. You are nothing but a shell of who you could be, there to perform and serve everyone else's needs. I also taught leadership development skills for negotiation, difficult conversations, feedback across industries on six continents. And even though the tools and frameworks that my colleagues at the Harvard Negotiation Project created, I believe, are sound, some people still wouldn't negotiate. Some people still wouldn't have the difficult conversations. Some people still wouldn't give or receive feedback, no matter how much their manager or HR told them they should. And why is that? Silence. We've all learned to stay silent. We've benefited, often been rewarded for not rocking the boat. If you keep your mouth shut, if you toe the party line, maybe you'll get promoted. And the people around us, including our well-intentioned managers and leaders, continue to silence us, to make us fit into the preordained boxes that they have for us, the stereotypes and biases that we then have to navigate through. And of course, silence is baked into our systems, the policies and practices that disproportionately support or silence different people. So if we really want to be able to speak up, it's not a Nike just do it approach. It is how do we actually solve for silence in the ways that I silence myself, silence the people around me, and then tackle the ways that silence is baked into the systems.
Have you ever received feedback from a line manager that you should just have more confidence and use your voice and speak up and speak louder? Many, many women have come into coaching sessions with me feeling frustrated as to what they should do with this feedback. So let's bring Elaine in. Can you share some insights here, Elaine? Is this purely a confidence issue?
Speaking up is not a matter of courage. Does it take courage? Yes. Courage is necessary, but not sufficient. Is speaking up a matter of confidence? Sure, it takes confidence, but speaking up fundamentally is not about a deficiency in you of lack of courage and lack of confidence. Whether or not we speak up is a calculation. Part of the calculation is, do I know how to do it? Do I have the skill set? Another part of the calculation is it safe and worth it? So there is the part that we can control, and then there's the part that the other people around us need to shift. One of the healthy boundaries to maintain is to be really clear about what is your work to do and what is the work of your line manager, your leader, and also the corporate culture that you're in, their work to do. It's not all on you. Part of my frustration and why I wrote the book is because the problem has been phrased as women go fix yourself. And in phrasing the problem in that way, it absolves everyone else of responsibility or supposed liability. But if we can answer the right question, we have a much better chance of actually making progress and doing it in a way that is healthy and sustainable for us and changing the things that actually need to change, which is not just us.
45% of Americans regularly self-censor for fear that expressing their view will isolate and alienate them from others. That's a stat from chapter 4 of Elaine's book. Let's dig in a little bit more. What are some of the reasons why we might silence ourselves? There's a whole chapter in Elaine's book, but I've selected a few to share here. So number one, we assume that our voices don't matter. Maybe you're the person with the least seniority in the room, or you're the newest to the company. I remember this in my early investment banking days, being the newest and sometimes the only woman in a room, or the feeling of being publicly shut down by a more senior man during a meeting, incredibly frustrating. So number one, we assume our voices don't matter. Number two, we might be over-focused on others' expectations. So I coached a senior doctor whose parents had moved from India to England, and she was passionate about music, not medicine. But because of the sacrifices her parents had made to get there and to create the education for her and all the things that they had done to raise her and the family, there was this constant reminder that creative pursuits don't pay the bills. So she silenced herself. And now this woman is middle-aged, well into a career she never wanted, and she feels this pent-up anger towards her family that she's unable to express. That's taking a toll on her mental health and motivation. So that's another reason we might silence ourselves. We might be over-focused on others' expectations. Number three, we mitigate our speech. Now that's a term popularized by author Malcolm Gladwell, defining it as a way of softening the meaning of what we're saying, perhaps making it more agreeable to those in power. So Elaine adds that women and people of color have learned to mitigate their speech to be more palatable to those in power, but then they're often given feedback that they're not being as clear or direct as they should be. Cue the frustration. So more generally, this happens with friends and family too. Think of the emojis you might use in a text message when you're being direct, or the softeners like, I hope it's okay that I said that. So the third way, we mitigate our speech. So let's get practical. Sorry, big Olivia Newton-John fan here. Elaine is going to give you a way of challenging someone in a difficult conversation. You might want to grab a pen and a notepad.
Part of the skill set of speaking up when there is conflict is not using comfort as a metric for whether it makes sense to speak up. It is inherently uncomfortable to disagree with someone, particularly when they make it uncomfortable. But to be able to see that clearly, that discomfort is not a reason not to speak up. Very tactically, sometimes there's the question of what are the words that can come out of my mouth? One phrase that I love to go to is, I see it differently. Different doesn't mean bad or wrong. Different doesn't mean you're judging them or blaming them. Different is just different. There's a culture piece as to how difference is perceived in an environment that gets to organizational health that we can unpack further. But fundamentally, I see it differently. Another go-to phrase for me is from where I sit. From where I sit recognizes that your view is limited and legitimate based on your life experience, your role, maybe your geography, your fill in the blank. You see the world like no one else does. You saying, from where I sit, this is, I think the deadline is unrealistic. How do things look from where you sit? That allows us to have that constructive dialogue that assumes we have different perspectives. And your view is legitimate and limited, just like their view is legitimate and limited. But one of the ways that we silence ourselves is to anticipate that they will see things differently. And in anticipating that they see it differently, we allow their norm, their narrative to dominate versus bringing to the mix what is inherently our data set and our perspective. We're comfortable with staying silent because we have learned that often as a coping mechanism. So comfort is a metric for what we're used to, not a metric for what we're capable of.
If you're a leader, even a well-intentioned, approachable one, let's explore how you might be silencing people who report to you. Elaine, what do we need to know?
Leaders need to read this book. The book is a call to action for well-intentioned leaders to better align their typically good intentions with the impact they're actually having. I have never met a leader who says, I want to silence my people. Most leaders I work with have direct reports who do not feel comfortable talking to them about what they really think, feel, or see. Some of that is organizational silence. Some of that is culture, but culture is the collective of all of our actions and the norms that we co-create. The other piece that we know is silence breeds silence. If we do not see our leaders, our managers speaking up, actively engaging in constructive dialogue where we share differences of perspective, then how much less likely is it for us? Particularly if we are women, we carry any subordinated identity in a dominant culture, right? Our strategy is to observe what goes on around here. And we very rightfully conclude, oh, I guess we don't talk about those things here. So when I am coaching leaders, regardless of gender, to me, silence is a leadership issue, not a women's issue. It is a culture issue, not an individual flaw. We each have a responsibility, and leaders have a disproportionate responsibility to co-create and lead the creation of a culture of voice rather than perpetuate a culture of silence. When I'm working with organizations, it's that three-level analysis. Yes, you want your people to speak up. Fantastic. We can work on building that skill set. And it would be irresponsible of me to say, if you send your women to a workshop on speaking up, that they will be able to come back and speak up if nothing else around them changes. So the second piece of work we do is in high potential leadership development programs, in, you know, executive leadership programs. What is your role as a leader in creating a space where people can use their voices, in creating a culture of voice? And then we can look at third piece is that culture audit systems, which are created by policies and practices. Are we being honest about who our policies and practices support and who they silence? Because so often we say, well, it's just the policy. There are always assumptions baked into the policy. We tend to not honestly discuss those. I'm so tired of talking about return to office and hybrid, as I know many of us are. Why is that issue such a lightning rod? Because it supports the people who have short commutes, have developed skill sets in an ability to lead in person. It silences the people who have longer commutes or more arduous commutes and have higher caregiving responsibilities and a greater need for flexibility. But we're not being honest in our conversation about why we're drawing the lines. We're saying it's for productivity. Power is invisible to those who have it. So the great irony of becoming more senior is that you hold a role. If you are a senior vice president, you may not see yourself, you still see yourself as a really approachable person. I have not changed. You have changed. You don't see it. But you don't see yourself as threatening. Whereas by nature of inhabiting that role and holding the job title, people are not talking to you, approachable leader. People are talking to an SVP and all the assumptions that they have. So we forget how hard it is to speak up. One of the ways leaders silence the people they lead is that we forget how challenging it is. Also, if it's not something you've struggled with, I had this conversation with my husband when I was writing the book. He was like, he is a white, straight, cis man from the Midwest in the United States. And he said, I could not write this book because I have never been silenced. His voice has always been normed because he carries the dominant identities in corporate spaces. So we silence people by saying, it's so easy, you should be able to do it because I can do it too. Just that cognitive awareness that this is challenging makes a fundamental difference because we know that behavior is fundamentally driven by assumptions and mindset. So your awareness as a leader starts to open up a set of questions around how you can actually support people. So one is the mindset piece. Another subtle way that we as leaders silence the people around us is we assume that people are wired like us. And so if I process information in real time, then I assume other people process information in real time as well. So I say, let's jump on a call. That may be how you best process information, but it is not how every human being processes information. So in the book, I draw this distinction between real-time processors and post-processors. Real-time processors metabolize information best by talking it through in real time. Post-processors are those of us who in a meeting, we can't quite figure out what to say. 20 minutes after the meeting, we're like, that's what I wanted to say. As a leader, I don't want people's fastest thinking. I want their best thinking. If their best ideas are going to come up 20 minutes after the meeting, let's design for that. If their best thinking, best communication comes in typing rather than talking, how can we legitimize email or Slack or any of these asynchronous tools to elevate thoughts that come in those formats as much as real-time conversation? If our assumption of leadership and worth of thoughts is that they have to come packaged in three succinct bullet points with no ums, just the right amount of emotion to show that you care, but not too much emotion that women particularly lose credibility. We are creating these barriers to entry in the conversation, barriers to being heard. And that is coupled with the power dynamic we discussed, which is if we are not actively designing the way that we communicate, we default to the patterns of the people with the most power, seniority, or the way that things have always been done. So a practical way of bringing this to life is to take one standing meeting that you have on your calendar and optimize that meeting by designing how it works. So do you know how the people on your team who report to you best communicate? What makes it easiest for them to share their thoughts and feelings? Is it typing? Is it talking? Is it real time? Is it asynchronous? Is it in the morning? Is it in the evening? All of these different factors. If you don't know the answers to those questions about the people on your team, ask them. It's a 30-second conversation. Better yet, for post-processors, put it in an email to them and say, hey, in our next one-on-one next week, this is a question I'd like to tackle. Get that intel that you normally get over time by trial and error, but be efficient about discussing it.
In this part of the episode, I bring Elaine onto the hot seat and I give her an anonymized real-life coaching scenario to get her perspective on it. So these are situations that have come up again and again and again over the years of my coaching practice, so I suspect you'll find them useful. I've changed any identifying details. It's the scenario that we're focused on. So the first one involves a senior female executive in the fintech space. She's the only woman executive on the team, and her male boss often publicly undercuts her and shuts her down during internal meetings. So when she tries to bring it up with him one-on-one, he says, oh, you're lacking confidence. You've just got to toughen up. She's never thought she was one to lack confidence, but now she's doubting herself and her mental health and energy is suffering. Because she's tried addressing it with him multiple times with no effect, she's kind of given up and she feels isolated and powerless. In other words, she's gone silent. Elaine, what are your thoughts?
Our work is to figure out how much weight to give to the voices that are in our life. Now, our boss's voice, our manager, has a lot of weight because of the practical setup. And in this scenario, particularly if you have already raised it multiple times with him, I would argue the negotiation is with yourself of whether you want to continue to raise it if it has not yet had much effect. Chapter 3 of the book is when silence makes sense. So often, silence is an act of self-care, of survival, and of self-preservation. If someone else is unwilling to hear you, unwilling to see you, there's only so much you can do. Their inability or unwillingness to change is not a personal failure on your part. The work that is ours to do is to continue to nourish our sense of self, to know that not being heard is actually not a lack of confidence. If you want them to listen to this episode, fantastic, or have them read the book so that someone else can tell them the impact that they are having on you. That's the inner work. What is incredibly difficult then is how you can not only survive, but continue to progress in a context where that manager is saying, here's what you need to do in order to progress. One question I would have is, who are the other stakeholders? Who are the other players other than your direct manager? Are there any allies, any people who have the ability to see your brilliance and who can disrupt that bias on your behalf? Because unlearning silence is not an individual sport. It is a team sport. So who is on your team and how can the people on your team help you do the inner and the outer work? The inner work is maintaining your sense of self, not letting your manager's thoughts further deteriorate your confidence, your sense of self. And so what we need there is people who say you do you, people who affirm you, people who diagnose the situation accurately. And particularly when we're the first, the few, or the only, can feel like, well, who actually gets it? That's where strangers or podcasts or authors can be really helpful, because on your team is not just the people who are geographically proximate to you. On your team are all the voices and influences that you let into your life. So how can you supplement the voices that are naturally in your life with the voices that will support you for who you are and who you are becoming? Then there is the very practical team of who are the other stakeholders. And I do a little bit of a stakeholder analysis to say, other than my manager, who has power in the system? What are the different levers? I would also remind myself that even if we don't think that our BATNA, our best alternative to a negotiated agreement, is very good, that we do have other options other than staying here and making it work. And part of the external work is, okay, if I've tried having this conversation and nothing's budging, what else could I do? If I've tried to make it work here and they're choosing not to change, what might I do instead to make sure that my needs are sufficiently met? We forget that we have other options because we've sunk so much cost here, right? The sunk cost fallacy, because we tell ourselves, oh, it's good enough. To me, it never hurts to look, to find out what else is out there, because you could always choose and realize that what you have here, however flawed, with your manager is still better than the outside. But not looking at all, we assume that this is our only option. when really there are options that we haven't even considered, haven't even discovered, haven't even dreamt up that are worth exploring.
Are you up for another one?
Yeah. This is fun.
I'm a female senior executive, and I've been generous and shared contacts with a new male, and I'm air quoting here, superstar that we've hired in my firm. I do want him to succeed, but he's stealing the limelight, especially with my long-established clients that I've shared. I know visibility is key at this stage of my career. I'm not one to push myself forward. Elaine, what should I do?
Why are you not one to push yourself forward? I'd start by interrogating that. Again, is it discomfort? Is it a value that you hold? Is that assumption of, you know, I work hard and then will be rewarded, or I don't want to be that person? We you know, we see those people who take up a lot of space, and so we don't want to be that person. We don't want to be pushy. We don't want to be braggy. All those things, I would start by interrogating, right? What is it? Because not taking up space is part of our learned silence. When I started writing this book, I had a sticker on my computer that said, "You deserve to take up space," because that was not something that I thought was true. I made myself valuable over time by making myself small, by not having any needs or concerns to solve for. I was easy to work with. I was just there to serve other people. That also means that I'm only there for my utility rather than my humanity. Do I get to be fully human? Including, it's okay for me to be visible. So if you're not comfortable being visible, I'd interrogate that. If you're not comfortable, you don't want to be someone who cares about those things, I would interrogate that. And by interrogate, I mean wrestle with, ask questions, sort of poke holes in. And you may still land on, yeah, that's not what I want to do. And that is okay, but you will do so with greater confidence of the game you want to play. What I fundamentally hear in this dynamic is that you are coming from a place of an abundance mindset. You have an operating assumption that I will be generous with my connections. We together will be able to create more. And I hear his behaviors operating from a scarcity mindset or a taking, grabbing mindset. So fundamentally, you have different operating assumptions. There are a couple of ways you could handle it. One is a direct conversation with him, which is to say, here's my intent in sharing contacts. Here's my implicit assumption of what you would also do, right? We are in this business together. I share contacts, you share contacts. We all over time make each other look good. What is happening from where I sit is that people are seeing you and they're not seeing me, which doesn't serve us, our team effort, over time. See what he says, because often he has no idea. He's just delighted. He's moving through the world doing what he does. So one question is whether you want to take on that feedback conversation and whether that approach of observing what's happening, naming the implicit assumption, and sharing the impact is a conversation that feels doable in that context. The other piece I would note, though, is that there are people who have different operating assumptions. Some people operate from a scarcity mindset. Some people operate from an abundance mindset. And over time, it is sorting through who you want in your life. And that those boundaries, Dr. Pooja Lakshman in Real Self-Care has taught me that boundaries are not co-created. So we're not asking people, are you okay with that if I don't do this? Over time, we find each other and find the people who have the same operating assumption that we do about how the world works. But it does take trial and error, and the explicit conversation often helps.
Okay, we've got two more questions. The next one is about trying to fit in at work and editing oneself. I'm a woman of color. I've spent years fitting in my corporate role, but never feeling like I really belong. I feel like I've had to bring a particular version of myself to work and no one would know. It's exhausting. Elaine, do you have any tips?
Let me start with validation, or what I hope is validation, which is, this completely makes sense. This is the fact pattern that most every woman of color, even having to use that phrase, right? Each woman who is not white, straight, cis, in a dominant culture has to consider. Oftentimes there can be blame and shame of how did I let this happen? I would encourage us to skip over that and say this is by nature what happens. Anytime you carry a subordinate identity, you are more likely to be othered, less likely to be trusted, more likely to be cut out. And so the mimicry is a natural strategy. Experts on influence also prescribe that you act like people. People are more likely to want to say yes to you, to like you, to want to work with you if you look and sound like them. So as an Asian American woman, it was 10 years into working in a predominantly white, even women dominated organization before I realized I had never used chopsticks to eat my lunch, even though I use chopsticks in the evening. No one ever said that there was no rule of no chopsticks. No one ever said you can't do it. It wasn't until an admin of ours years later was eating ramen with her chopsticks that I realized, wow, I have self-edited. That's how deep, how subtle, how invasive silence is, because we don't even realize that we've edited out that part of ourselves. And it is exhausting. It is work to have to edit, to have to self-censor. And often we don't realize we're doing it, because if we've been censored by other people, it's not all that different when we do it to ourselves. One question I would wrestle with is, what are the actual norms in your current workplace? Not what assumptions do you have about this current workplace, not what was true of your last manager, last team, last workplace, but what is actually allowed here, and what's actually rewarded here. And what's tricky is we learned these coping mechanisms of trying to fit in, editing ourselves because of real negative experiences in our past. The question is what happened in the past still true today? It may be. It may not be. I'd also ask the question, how can you be sufficiently whole? Some of us compartmentalize work, and it's just what pays the bills. I don't really need to thrive at work because there's a utility and a function, and I know very clearly where it sits in our lives. For some of us, it really matters to be able to bring more of us. The line between healthy workplace and toxic workplace is a really blurry one. And at different seasons in life, you may value different things. I go back to the core of agency, which is, what do you need today? Often I'm asked the question, how do I find my voice? And there's a bit of shame and sadness that comes with that question, because it is really disorienting to wake up as a highly accomplished individual and professional and realize I don't know what my voice is. And I say this with compassion because it is very much my experience. I have a ton of external credentials, right? I taught at Harvard Law School. I was a partner at a global leadership development firm. I've done all these things. How could I not know what my voice is? Except if your success is based on or seems like it's based on imitating other people, on mimicking other people, on editing out parts of yourself, we very naturally lose a sense of ourselves, a sense of our own voice. And it's not like the world is watching out for us either. As a mother in particular, or as a caregiver of any sort, everyone else's needs take precedent over my own. So the radical act of rediscovering our voice or finding it is twofold. One is to ask yourself, what do I think and what do I need? If no one else is considering your needs, then it is on us to be able to identify what do I need, and that awareness prompts that information. And also, what do I think? Not what does my manager think, not what does the organization want me to think, not what does my mother think, but what do I think? Reminds us that we have a unique lens and view of the world that is limited and legitimate. So if you're looking for your voice to re-nurture it, what do I think? What do I need? The exhaustion is real. Because essentially what you're doing, you're taking on four things, at least four things at the same time. One is healing from past pain, trauma, capital T trauma or lowercase t trauma. It is having to educate people about what's going on because no one else can see it or see it as clearly. It is having to, number three, deal with their resistance, their defensiveness, their gaslighting of you when you try to educate. And number four, do your day job, which women tend to disproportionately hold, office housework, relational labor, and that's just at work, not to mention at home. So notice that you're doing at least four things at the same time, trying to heal, trying to educate, managing the resistance, and doing your day job. No wonder we're exhausted. To me, that is a call to action for each of us, to see how we can show up for each other. Because the tension when we're the only is that if I don't say something, nothing will change because no one else can see it. This is the invitation for people who want to be allies, to read, to listen, to do that education work, to not get defensive, to choose curiosity, to choose appreciation when someone takes the risk to share something that you had not considered before, to focus on what they're saying instead of focusing on your reaction, which is another way that leaders silence people. If we to disrupt bias, if we're all doing that work, then it is not on any single one of us. And that means that we have the opportunity to rest, to take a breath, and the work still gets done, and we continue to build toward a future where belonging, dignity, and justice are true for every human being and not just a privileged few. But I want to start with that awareness of it makes sense that you're exhausted. It is not a personal failure. It is not because you are not strong enough. It is not because you are not resilient enough. It is because those four categories of work are too much for anyone to do at any given time. The clarity I would offer is to say, in this moment, which of those pieces of work am I going to do? And choose one, even though the world might have us do all four.
I had a senior female client express frustration a few years ago during a coaching session. She said, I know, I've just been promoted and I'm grateful for that. But honestly, I feel like I'm the token vagina in the room. Another client wondered if she'd just been promoted because the firm is trying to improve its DE&I statistics. And a woman of color I was in conversation with mentioned that she's always rolled out for panels to show that the organization isn't just white men. Something she said was good, of course, but it also gave her more to do. I've really enjoyed having Elaine's perspective on all of these questions, and I hope you're finding it like your very own mini mentoring session. So let's dive in to the final question.
Also, Mandy, I so appreciate these questions. Thank you for your thoughtfulness and getting to be real. about it. That sense of being tokenized is so real. And I say that having lived that, right? Anytime that we need a non-white male conference speaker, my name comes up. When in the ivory tower, we needed to show that we weren't just white, somehow my name came up more often. And then I was told, oh, no, you're here because you're fantastic. And it's really hard to reconcile both those things. That's a long way of saying you're not making it up. And whether or not the people around you can really value you for all you bring, you are still in that role. You are still the CEO. You are still the fill-in-the-blank title. You still have a seat at the table. The question is what you want to do with that seat. Now, just because you have a seat at the table doesn't mean that you get heard. If you are like any of the other women that I have coached that we know, you are constantly doing all the calculations of, should I spend my social capital there? What's going to happen if I can't screw it up? Because that means they will not let any other woman into this seat. It's a lot of weight, and that weight is not all on us, including, is it healthy for you to stay here too? So many of us are unwilling to step away because then it really is an all-male team. They don't even have a token. So one question I'd ask is, what is good for you? What do you need? And is that being met here? The other thought is, regardless of whether people can see all you bring, you still hold the seat. So what do you want to do with it? Third, their inability to see beyond the surface level or their own insecurities to say you're only here because we needed a fill in the blank, because we needed a woman. That's on them, not on you. That is their work to learn, to journey. If you choose to educate, if you choose to fight that battle, fantastic. Thank you for doing that work. And it is not on you to fundamentally change their inability to see all that you bring. This question resonates deeply because when I sold the book, I'm a first-time author. My book sold at auction. I sold it to the largest publisher in the entire world, Penguin Random House. I sold global rights. They started selling translation. It's slated to be translated into 10 languages even before I wrote it. And someone said, Elaine, you only got a book deal because publishing is dealing with their guilt from the wave of anti-Asian hate. That's part of why the question strikes deep. But I had a choice, and I think every woman does too, which is whether or not I got this deal because of publishing's guilt, I still got the deal. The book is still out in the world. Can I write the best damn book possible that helps women and anyone who has been silenced feel seen, known, and heard, to actively diagnose the question more accurately and offer practical solutions for each of us to unlearn our own silence, unlearn the ways that we silence other people, and change the system? It doesn't matter if the reasons why I got the deal or why you got the role.
If you're new to this show, at the end of every episode, I ask the guest to leave a brick of wisdom, a gift of insight. So here's what Elaine left for you.
I'm going to say it rather than judge myself for it and wish that I could come up with something more novel, more fill in the blank, because that is fundamentally the exercise at hand. The brick of wisdom I'd leave is simple, but not easy to accept, which is you are enough. You are enough as you are. You are enough not because of what you can produce, but because you are human. Your thoughts, your needs, your preferences, your dreams, they matter. You are enough.
There is so much to digest in this podcast. You might want to head over to my website. And if you click on the Listen tab, you can find transcripts for each episode in case you want to grab your cup of tea and your orange highlighter and process these episodes in writing as well. You'll also find all of Elaine's details in the show notes. My big takeaway is thinking about how I might unknowingly be silencing others, especially as I process out loud, I'm quite vocal, I prefer face-to-face discussions. What about you? What's your insight? I'm going to post about this episode on Instagram and on LinkedIn, so do join the discussion there and share what your insights have been. Two things before you get back into your day. Who do you know who would benefit from this episode? This podcast grows because of the generous shares and word of mouth marketing when someone like you listens to an episode, has an aha moment, and shares it with a friend or a colleague. So thank you in advance for sharing this conversation with whoever came to mind as you were listening. And second, if you haven't already clicked the follow button on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, please do that. It helps the show to grow, and it also means you never miss an episode. We've got some great ones in the pipeline. As ever, thank you for listening. Let's do this all again in 2 weeks.